Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, May 13th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. First, COVID-19-related death confirmed in Webster County. The first death related to COVID-19 in Webster County was confirmed Wednesday by the Webster County Public Health Department. That person was between the ages of 41 and 60, according to officials. That person died Wednesday. The resident is among 17 other deaths across the state announced Wednesday by the Iowa Department of Public Health. "We wish to extend our sympathy to this individual's family," said Webster County Public Health Director Carrie Prescott. Webster County Public Health and all of our key partners throughout the country and state continue to work to limit the spread and impact of this virus in our communities. We ask that our residents respect the privacy of this family and please continue to take preventative measures. Webster County now has 12 confirmed cases of COVID-19, up from 11 on Tuesday. The cases fall into the following categories: child aged 0 to 17, 1. Adult age 18 to 40, 4. Middle-aged adult age 41 to 60, 4. Older adult age 61 to 80, 3. As of Wednesday, 5 of the cases have recovered since their diagnosis. A total of 916 people have been tested for COVID-19 in Webster County, about 2.6% of the county's current estimated population, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Statewide, 377 more people tested positive, pushing the total to 13,289 on Wednesday. The news comes on the same day that Governor Kim Reynolds announced that restrictions partially lifted on businesses like restaurants, non-essential retail stores, and gyms will be expanded to all 99 counties on Friday. Other establishments that were still mandated to close, like salons and barbershops, will be allowed to reopen Friday. The IDPH notes that a total of 4,454 people in Webster County have taken an online assessment via Test Iowa, the state's testing initiative. Assessments do not reflect the number of people who have received a diagnostic test for COVID-19. Webster County Public Health notifies all people who come into close contact with someone who tests positive for COVID-19. Webster County Public Health Department strongly encourages all vulnerable persons, including those with pre-existing medical conditions and those older than 65, to limit their activities outside their home, including visits to businesses and other establishments, and their participation in gatherings of any size and any purpose. The Health Department encourages all Webster County residents to limit their in-person interactions with vulnerable persons and to exercise particular care and caution when engaging in any necessary interactions. First child COVID-19 case confirmed in Webster County. The first child to test positive for COVID-19 was confirmed by Webster County Public Health Tuesday evening, bringing the county to 11 cases total. "It is important to remember that our numbers will ebb and flow back and forth as positive tests are received and disease investigations completed," said Webster County Public Health Director Carrie Prescott. "Once we validate residency and contact tracing for each positive patient, we will update the public with factual information." Fort Dodge Public Library offering outside book pickup again. Books will be quarantined and disinfected between uses. When the concerns over COVID-19 began in March and the city of Fort Dodge decided to close the Fort Dodge Public Library, the library found a way to continue servicing its patrons: curbside pickup of library books and audiobooks. The FDPL continued that option for about a week before ceasing. As of Monday, the library has resumed that service for its patrons. The governor has lifted restrictions, and one of the things she allowed was the library to open to the public if they felt it was safe, said Rita Schmidt, FDPL director. "We don't have in place yet all of the measures we would like to have in place to keep patrons and staff safe, so we are looking at a phased reopening, and the first step is starting curbside service." So while Governor Kim Reynolds has given the all clear for public libraries to open again, the Fort Dodge Public Library will be taking its time opening its doors, closely monitoring the COVID-19 situation in Webster County. Schmidt said that the library staff felt that this was a good time to restart the curbside service, as the weather is nicer and the library has processes in place to keep everyone safe. We have the ability now to handle the books that are going to be returned, making sure that they are either quarantined or disinfected so they are safe for staff to handle, and if it's something another patron would like, it's safe to do so, she said. With the library's curbside service, library patrons can either reserve book and audiobook titles through the library's online catalog at fortdodgelibrary.org, or they can call the library at 515-573-8167 to request items from a librarian. For parents or guardians of younger readers who may not know what books they want to check out, the children's librarian is available to help pick out a handful of age-appropriate reading. At this time, DVDs and magazines are not available for checkout. When a patron's order is filled, a librarian will call to let them know. Patrons can pick up their items from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. and from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. When the patron arrives at the library, they will need to call the library phone number, and a librarian will place their items in a bag and set it on a cart right outside the library doors. Patrons will not enter the library. When the library items come back, a staff member will retrieve them from the outside book drop while wearing gloves and will set them aside in an area where they can be quarantined, so to speak, for 72 hours, Schmidt said. For newer and more popular books, the library staff will be spraying them with disinfectant and putting them in quarantine for 24 hours before another patron can check the item out. Schmidt encourages community members to use some of the extra time they have now to read so they can focus on something other than the chaos, the new normal. A way to step outside your daily routine and experience something new or different, she said. It's a way to perhaps travel, even though you can't. You might check out a book on traveling and different places to go for your dream vacation for when we can start safely going other places. It's just a good way to pass the time and enrich our lives. Throughout the library's closure, the library staff was hard at work ordering new materials and cataloging the new materials that came in, so there are plenty of new titles on the shelves ready for checkout. Though Schmidt and the rest of the library staff are happy to provide library services in this way, nothing compares to seeing their favorite patrons in the library every day. "We really do miss our patrons," Schmidt said. "Obviously, we would prefer to be open, but until we can make sure we can keep everyone safe, this is a compromise." Webster County Courthouse reopens. The Webster County Courthouse reopened its doors to the public this week after several weeks of availability by phone and appointment only. County officials asked the public to process paperwork and payments as much as possible through the drop box located in the alley between the Messengers Building and the courthouse, or via mail. Officials continue to ask those who are sick or are displaying COVID-19 symptoms to do their business remotely via mail or by calling the appropriate department. Assessor Angie Vinson said that the Board of Review had extended the deadline to file an appeal to June 5th due to coronavirus. Auditor Doreen Pliner encourages the public to vote absentee, either by requesting a ballot to mail or by using the new in-person early voting location at the Webster County Social Services Building, 330 First Avenue North. The location will be open for primary election voting Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. until the June 2nd election. Absentee ballots must be postmarked by midnight on June 1st. Only three locations will be available for in-person voting on June 2nd for the entire county. Permits from the county engineer can be obtained online at webstercountyia.org and submitted via email to permits@webstercountyia.org. Planning and zoning permits are available online or at the office via appointment. To find the date your title transfer paperwork is due to the treasurer's office without penalty, per the governor's proclamation, please visit the treasurer page at webstercountyia.org. Vehicle registrations expiring between January and April are due before June 28th this year without penalty. Penalty enforcement begins June 28th for January, February, March, and April 2021 registrations. The last day to pay property taxes without penalty is May 27th. The Veteran Affairs Office is open by appointment only, according to Director Dan Lewandowski. While the clerk of court is not open to the public, citizens can call for assistance. Webster County Supervisors OK payments, fund transfers. Webster County Supervisors approved several payments, fund transfers, and allocations Tuesday. Funds awarded by the 2019 Burn Justice Assistance Grant Program were allocated to departments by supervisors as follows: $8,881 to the Webster County Sheriff's Office to purchase equipment and training, $9,881 to the Fort Dodge Police Department for equipment and training, and $1,000 to the Joint Drug Task Force between both departments for training. Total Veterans Affairs geographic expenditures for the last fiscal year were up nearly $2 million, according to a report from Director Dan Lewandowski, while total vets served were down 75 to 2,572, the lowest number in the last 6 years for the local department. The compensation and pension category saw the biggest increase in expenditures, accounting for a majority of the nearly $2 million overall increase. That category covers service-connected injuries and pensions. This is a snapshot of what we put out every fiscal year, Lewandowski said. Supervisors approved their second payment to Des Moines contractor Newman Brothers for $297,151 for courthouse renovations. Supervisor Nick Carlson said the renovation project is continuing smoothly as contractors finish removing copper from the clock tower structure this week. Newman Brothers will continue to put up scaffolding for light installation over the next 2 weeks. Supervisors approved a $488,050 transfer from Lost Fund 0052 to Debt Service Fund 2000 for payment on improvements done to the Webster County Law Enforcement Center a few years ago. They also approved a transfer of $483,600 from the Secondary Road Fund 0020 as a payment for a newer building for the Secondary Roads Department. It's the fourth of 10 payments, according to County Engineer Jamie Joel. Rockwell City man missing. Local and state law enforcement officers are searching for a Rockwell City man who was reported missing on May 3rd. Christian Daniel Bulk Thompson, 26, is a white male, 6 feet 1 inch tall, 180 pounds, with light brown hair, hazel eyes, and wears eyeglasses. Bulk Thompson has several tattoos, including bats on his right arm, a bullet on the side of his neck, and his mother Michelle's name on his left forearm. He also goes by BT. Bulk Thompson is currently listed as a missing person, and law enforcement is actively working the case, Special Agent Ray Fiedler, Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, said. At this time, not much is known, Fiedler said. We're just continuing running down leads and really don't know if he left on his own, he said. I can't say if there was foul play. I can't say he left on his own. I just don't know. Fiedler said the DCI can't give out much information on whether Bulk Thompson is believed to have any personal items or a vehicle with him, as it could hinder the investigation. There are certain things that we're looking at, but I don't want to give that out because only certain people would know that, he said. Michelle Bulk, Bulk Thompson's mother, said she last saw her son on April 29th for his son's birthday party. Bulk Thompson has two young sons at home. He wanted to talk to me. We didn't get to talk that night, she said. Then on Saturday, when I tried to call and text him, his phone was off. So I just thought it was off or dead and didn't think much of it. Bulk said she's felt like she's just been going around in circles, trying to talk to Bulk Thompson's friends and trying to see if they know where he is or what happened. I just think somebody had to have seen something, and if they're his so-called friends, I don't know why they wouldn't help, she said. Why wouldn't you help somebody come home to their children and their mother, whether it gets you in trouble or not? It's just unbelievable. Bulk Thompson's safe return home is his mother's top priority right now. We all want him to come home no matter what. It doesn't matter what happens, she said. We just want him to come home. His boys miss him. His whole family misses him. Everybody. Anyone with information on the whereabouts of Bulk Thompson is asked to call the Calhoun County Law Enforcement Center at 712-297-7583 or the Carroll County Sheriff's Office at 712-792-4393. Fort Dodge man charged with gun, drug possession after fatal crash. A Fort Dodge man has been charged with carrying weapons, possession of marijuana, and possession of methamphetamine after a fatal crash in Dickinson County. Shane Gailey, 30, was charged with the aggravated and serious misdemeanors on top of driving while barred after a May 2nd crash near the intersection of 310th Avenue and 170th Street in Spirit Lake. Reports said Louise Lopez Caraballo of Esterville crossed the center line while driving north in the 1700 block of County Highway N-14 shortly after 11 p.m. that day, hitting Gailey head-on. The 46-year-old man died of injuries from the crash 2 days later, after being extricated from his van that rolled over with a trailer in tow, blocking the roadway. Gailey's Ford F-150 landed in a nearby ditch. Search warrant applications from the Dickinson County Sheriff's Office said that a deputy given permission to get insurance documents from Gailey's truck spotted a glass jar with a trace amount of marijuana in the process. The deputy also found it suspect that Gailey was concerned enough about a small suitcase to hold it with him on the side of the road right after a serious accident. Gailey was administered one field sobriety test, results of which the deputy said could have been an indicator of marijuana use. Since Gailey was in pain from the accident, no other tests were administered. The search warrant application notes that a marijuana odor emanated from his vehicle even after it has been towed and stored in a shed. The Dickinson County Sheriff's Office seized two loaded Glocks, drug paraphernalia, and a drug ledger, marijuana, packages of rolling papers, and meth with a snort tube as they executed the search warrant. Gailey refused to provide a sample for urine analysis testing the night of the accident. John Gailey, Shane Gailey's father, was cited for allowing an unauthorized person to drive, as he was the registered owner of the vehicle in the crash, and Shane Gailey was barred from driving. An initial appearance for Shane Gailey has been scheduled for June 4th. Shining a light on hospital workers, Rebecca Johnson. Editor's note, in honor of National Hospital Week, The Messenger is delighted to feature 7 people who work at our local hospital, Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center. One person will be featured a day over the course of the next 7 issues of The Messenger. Each one of these people hold important positions at the hospital that may not always be recognized. We hope you enjoy getting to know them. Rebecca Johnson, formerly of Casper, Wyoming. What's your job at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center? Patient access and registration. How long have you worked at the hospital? 10 months in patient access. What's the toughest part about your job? The toughest part about my job would have to be helping patients understand their insurance benefits or discussing benefits while they are not feeling well. What's an interesting fact or two someone might not know about you? I am in the U.S. Army and I raise chickens out by Manson. How has the COVID-19 pandemic changed what you do on a daily basis? It has changed just about everything I do, from limiting patient interaction to providing a safer environment for our patients. A lot of positive things have come from this, even if right now it feels out of control. If you could have dinner with someone famous, who would it be? Joyce Myers, because she is just an inspirational woman. What's the best part of your day? The best part is interacting with patients and the close relationship I have with my wonderful coworkers. A Fort Dodge trailblazer, Sandra Anderson Price helped pave the way for local female students and athletes. From head coach Jackie Wild's Dodger volleyball dynasty to the modern-day achievements of the Fort Dodge Senior High softball, bowling, and competitive cheer programs at the state level, the team and individual success over the last 5 decades has been nothing short of spectacular. It's easy to forget, though, that before the 1970-71 school year, which featured the Dodgers' first official volleyball and softball squads, there were no organized sports for female high school students from Fort Dodge. That's why the stories of athletes like Sandra Anderson Price are important to both tell and preserve. It was a struggle for Price and her classmates to be taken seriously on the field, the course, or in the gym during their teenage years. Fort Dodge did not offer anything beyond intramural sports for girls, who would organize teams by homeroom and compete against each other either during physical education class or after school. "That's just the way it was at the time," said Price, a 1958 FDSH graduate. "We made the most of it. We played pretty much every sport we could. Basketball, volleyball, softball, all the way through badminton, but nothing was official or sanctioned. It was just an accepted standard, and although a lot of the smaller schools around Fort Dodge had teams, girls' basketball dates back to the 1920s in Iowa, with softball officially being offered in 1955, golf and tennis in 1956, and track and field in 1962, we just hadn't reached that point yet here. It was frustrating for us, of course, but we made the most of it. We really had to work hard to get the opportunities for the girls that the boys had." The attitude toward female athletics began to change during Price's time as a Dodger. In 1956, Sandy Brown, the daughter of Fort Dodge's first Schultz Award winner, David Brown, won the school's first female scholar athlete award. Two years later, as a senior, Price was recognized herself. "I loved every sport," said Price, who is now 79. "We had wonderful girls in my class and a terrific home room. The BPW Award, female honor, kind of became the equivalent of the Schultz Award. Florence Nordman was instrumental in getting that started. The top senior female athlete award at FDSH has carried Nordman's name since 1973. Golf was my favorite, though. And golf is where Price truly excelled, thanks in large part to her supportive parents, Harold and Catherine Anderson. I started playing when I was 11, Price said. My dad was really my mentor and coach. He was an outstanding athlete himself, a state champion in golf, bowling, and baseball. He first taught me the rules and etiquette of the game, and my love for it grew from there. My mom and dad both told me there wasn't anything in life you couldn't do as long as you put your mind to it. That may sound simple and standard now, but given the times, it wasn't necessarily normal to have even your parents tell a girl something like that. Mine really saw it as a type of discrimination to not let young women compete as athletes in high school. In 1957, Catherine Anderson pushed for her daughter and Sandra's classmates to find more opportunities through the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. She went to C.T. Fielhaver, the superintendent, school board member Dr. Otto Glesny, and some of the others, and really pushed for Fort Dodge to join the IGHSAU, Price said. Fortunately, that happened because of her persistence and the school board's cooperation. As a result, Price was able to participate with one other teammate in the district golf tournament that year. Price won the individual title but didn't compete at state because the Dodger team had only two team members at the time. "Up until that point, we had just played and practiced golf with the boys' team after school," Price said. "In order for us to even be able to play in the district meet, we at least needed a faculty sponsor. We had no coach, so we begged Georgia Waldberger, our geometry teacher who knew nothing about golf, to go with us, and she did." The trophy from districts is still in the case at FDSH. It's only about 10 inches tall. Price also had a groundbreaking student council experience. "Girls didn't try for student body president," Price said. "My senior year, I decided to run. I was up against four boys and only lost to one, so I got to be vice president. Again, that just wasn't something girls had done in the past. But I was always encouraged to pursue a challenge like that by my parents, and I'm happy they pushed me." After attending the University of Iowa, where she earned an undergraduate degree in nursing and completed graduate work in social work and family therapy, Price moved back to Fort Dodge with her husband, R. Thomas Price, a longtime local lawyer who retired in 2019. Sandra was a floor nurse at Trinity Regional Hospital who taught nursing at Iowa Central Community College, worked as a consultant for the AEA, and was a hospice counselor. The Prices have now been married for 59 years. We were in Des Moines for a year when Tom was with the Attorney General's office, and then we came back to Fort Dodge, said Price, who was twice honored by the governor's office as an Iowa Nurse of the Year. And I continued to compete in golf as much as possible. Price was a formidable player on the links, where she captured 11 Fort Dodge Country Club championships. She also teamed with her father to win two father-daughter state titles. In 1966, Price played in an exhibition match with Hall of Fame golfer Patty Berg at the FDCC. The legendary Berg, a founding member of the LPGA, who still has more career major championships than any other player, was in town for a golf clinic. It was Patty Berg, Bill Hurd, the country club pro, Todd Tischer, the men's FDCC club champion, and myself, Price said. We played two holes together after the clinic. I was so nervous. I was just glad to make contact on every shot. My golf clubs were Patty Berg clubs, and there she was, standing right next to me. Today, nearly 70,000 girls compete in 10 different sanctioned sports through Iowa High School Athletics. We built on our teams to leave a legacy for those young women who followed us, Price said. It definitely needed to be done. The time was right. It's good to revisit what was done in the past, which led to the present. Many young women never take the opportunity to read about what other women have endured or had to go through the years, and I don't ever want them to take it all for granted. An editorial. Iowa is one of the top 5 egg-producing states in the U.S. Industry is recognized during National Egg Month. Egg production is big business in Iowa. The state's roughly 60 million laying hens generate a remarkable 16 billion eggs each year, making Iowa the number one egg-producing state in the nation. The Iowa egg industry is a big purchaser of Iowa's other agricultural products. The state's layers consume 57 million bushels of corn and 28.5 million bushels of soybeans every year. The Iowa egg industry is responsible for about $2.2 billion worth of sales annually. This industry also contributes mightily to a positive employment picture in Iowa. According to the Iowa Egg Council, egg producers are responsible for about 8,800 jobs that generate $502 million each year in income for employees and $23 million annually in general tax revenues for the state. Iowa, Ohio, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and California are the top 5 egg-producing states in the United States. Together, they account for 50% of this country's egg production. In the nation as a whole, some 300 million egg-laying hens generate well over 200 million cases of shell eggs per year. Americans don't eat as many eggs as they once did. Even so, eggs remain a popular food choice and consumer demand remains high. Per capita egg consumption was 402 eggs per year at its highest point in 1945. Today, it's in the neighborhood of 282 eggs per person each year and has been holding fairly constant in recent years. Most of the nation's egg production goes toward meeting that demand, but egg producers also make a positive contribution to our nation's export economy. U.S. eggs and egg products are sold worldwide. May is National Egg Month. The next time you consume this tasty product, enjoy the moment, but reflect also on the egg industry's importance to Iowa. An editorial. Paycheck Protection Program needs oversight. Big companies should not be getting money smaller companies need to survive. When the history books are written on the government's response to the coronavirus pandemic, there ought to be a chapter devoted to the Paycheck Protection Program. It will make for fascinating and, in many respects, disappointing reading. Part of the $2.2 trillion Federal CARES Act, the program initially funded at $350 billion, is aimed at helping small businesses, those with fewer than 500 employees, which have been decimated by the shutdown of large parts of our economy. The idea was to keep them, and especially their workers, afloat. But there have been problems since the beginning. Among the biggest, that the program ran out of money almost immediately. Across the country, businesses that need the money were shut out of the initial round of funding, prompting Washington, D.C. to approve a second round. Early reporting suggests that Iowa fared better than most other states in the first round of funding. A Bloomberg News article last week said in the first 2 weeks of the program, Iowa ranked 6th among the states in terms of the amount of eligible payrolls covered by approved applications. Other states didn't do so well, notably California and New York. Illinois also did relatively poorly. The Bloomberg story said that Illinois ranked 31st. We should note that this refers to businesses that were approved for funding, not necessarily those that have received the money. Unfortunately, the program has been a boon to some big companies that never should have bellied up to the bar in the first place. Some big hotel and restaurant chains and manufacturers, some of them worth billions of dollars, got money from the program. This appears to have been done legally. Congress made conscious decisions to help the restaurant and hospitality industries so that even subsidiaries of larger chains could access the money. Still, some of this is beyond the pale. There have been reports that some of the corporate recipients boasted of their access to private capital shortly before going to the government for help. Even the Los Angeles Lakers, which ESPN reported is valued at more than $4 billion, got money. The Lakers, among some other companies, have returned the money or said they'll do so. Some, however, have refused to do the right thing and give the money back. This hardly seems to be what Congress or anybody had in mind for the Paycheck Protection Program. It was clearly aimed at businesses that did not have access to other funds. We understand that when Washington, D.C. shovels money out the door quickly, there are bound to be errors. But the amount of money being spent here is unprecedented. And when the original Paycheck Protection Program required that applicants certify they needed the money because of economic uncertainty, it seemed clearly ripe for abuse. No wonder the program ran out of money fast. A new installment of $310 billion has been added to the program, and that's a good thing. Interest is clearly robust. The Quad Cities Chamber of Commerce said last week that 68% of local businesses responding to one of its surveys said they'd applied for federal help, with the Paycheck Protection Program being the most popular. It also looks like the federal government has learned some lessons in dispersing its second round of PPP funding. The Treasury Department issued more explicit guidance saying that, in order to get money, applicants had to certify in good faith that their PPP loan request is necessary. The department also is requiring that companies consider whether they have access to funds from other sources when submitting an application. These are the kinds of safeguards that should have been put in place in the beginning, and it points to the need for aggressive congressional oversight of this and other coronavirus-related programs. The federal government is spending huge amounts of money, and while we support these expenditures in this time of crisis, auditors and watchdogs within the government must make sure the money goes to the people and businesses that truly need it. They should also be as aggressive as possible in retrieving the money from those who don't. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, May 13th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Patricia May Rasmussen. Patricia May Rasmussen, 78 years old, died on Tuesday, May 12th, at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. She had been diagnosed with terminal cancer 11 months prior and was under hospice care. She had fought cancer off and on for 28 years. Her strong will to live, unwavering faith in God, and the love and prayers of family and friends carried her through these last months. Patty, or Patsy as her mother called her, was born on October 1, 1941, in Mankato, Minnesota. She was the only child of her parents, Nellie Mae Good and Arthur Byron Williamson. She grew up in the Fort Dodge area, graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High in 1959, and graduated from Buena Vista College with a teaching degree. She was known for her ease and frequent conversation with even total strangers. She possessed a contagious smile, an angelic voice, and a passion for teaching. Throughout her life, she inspired people through constant encouragement, inspiring words, teaching, and mentorship. Even now, people are being changed by her witness, her encouragement, her instruction, and her faith. Her signature gift of teaching will never be forgotten. She saw talent in everyone and told them what she saw in them. Anyone who met Patty would not walk away unchanged. After graduating from college, she met the love of her life, Orville Rasmussen, albeit an unconventional meeting arranged by his third-grade daughter, Jane. It was love at first sight. The couple was married later that year on December 19, 1970, at the Church of Christ in Fort Dodge. Married for 49 years, Patty and Orville raised their 6 children, June Richardson, Orville Rasmussen Jr., Jane Boyle, Mark Rasmussen and spouse Christine, Leanna Simpson and spouse David, and Stephen Rasmussen and spouse Becky. Patty faithfully cared for family and friends through delicious cooking and baking from scratch. She was a woman of faith and the heart of the Rasmussen family. Patty shaped their spirituality by her tireless Christian example, teaching Sunday school and Bible studies. Patty loved to read, pray, sing, teach, bake, and clean. Patty was not one to sit still. Her greatest accomplishments were loving her husband, loving her family, teaching at Community Christian School, and at prisons in Rockwell City and Fort Dodge. Patty would always be ready with a cup of tea, a cookie, and a meal if you were to stop by. She loved by serving. Her greatest joy was finding Christ, and she often said, "When I found Christ, he was able to take all the broken pieces of my life and turn it into something good." Her forever prayer for her family, friends, and students was for them to see Christ in her and for them to choose Christ for themselves. Her surviving family members are her husband, Orville, their 6 children, 14 grandchildren, many great-grandchildren, and a great-great-granddaughter. She was preceded in death by her parents, her sons-in-law Bruce Boyle and Mike Richardson. Visitation will be held 9:30 a.m. Thursday, May 14th at Northfield Church, followed by the funeral service at 11 a.m. The funeral service will be live-streamed. Entombment will be held in North Lawn Mausoleum. Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services is entrusted with the arrangements. Memorials may be left to discretion of the family. Merlin H. Dyvig. Merlin H. Dyvig, 95, of Humboldt, passed away Monday, May 11th at the Southfield Wellness Community in Webster City. He is now very alive with his loving Savior, Jesus Christ. A private family service will be held at a later date. He is survived by his wife of 73 years, Betty Fievelt Dyvig of Humboldt, children Dennis Dyvig and spouse Susan of Nairobi, Kenya, Wayne Dyvig and spouse Renee, and Ed Dyvig and spouse Sarah of Humboldt, grandchildren Jody, Jeremy, Joshua, Hannah, and Jonah, and several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Ed and Mary Stone Dyvig, and brothers Donald, Norman, and Warren. Merlin H. Dyvig was born November 28, 1924, in a farmhouse near Pioneer. He attended Humboldt schools. Merlin was a tail gunner on a B-17 during World War II, was shot down over Germany, and was a POW for 6 months in Germany until General Patton liberated them at war's end. Returning to Humboldt, he met the love of his life while buying tickets at the movie theater. He was united in marriage to Betty Fievold in 1947. They made their home southwest of Humboldt, where they lived and farmed for 55 years, and where Merlin stayed active in the farming operation until his retirement at the age of 88. Merlin instilled a love of motorcycles, airplanes, and John Deere's in his 3 sons. He enjoyed farm life and spending time with Betty at home. He was an avid pilot of a Champ and could often be seen buzzing his neighbors out in the fields. Clarence Lehman. Clarence Lehman, 84, of Badger, died on Tuesday, May 12th, at his home in Badger. A visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. on Sunday, May 17th, at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. A service will be held 3 p.m. on Sunday, May 17th, at Gunderson's. Burial will take place at Colfax Township Cemetery in Vincent at a later date. Clarence Lehman, the son of Lawrence and Amanda Licht Lehman, was born on January 26, 1936, in Vincent. Clarence Lehman was united in marriage to Barbara Huffman on May 6, 1961, at St. John Lutheran Church near Vincent. Clarence worked for many years at New Co-op in Vincent until he retired as a manager in 1995. In his spare time, Clarence enjoyed fishing, gardening, and woodworking. He especially loved his Canada fishing trips and spending time with family. Clarence is survived by his wife, Barb, children, Stephen Lehman and spouse, Leslie, Linda Van Rokel and spouse, Carl, Tracy Glasson and spouse, Bert, and Scott Lehman and spouse, Kathy, 17 grandchildren, several great-grandchildren, and his brothers, Don Lehman and spouse, Luanna, Earl Lehman and spouse, Pat, and Alan Lehman and spouse, Joyce. Clarence was preceded in death by his daughter, Lori, his son-in-law, Mike, and his parents, Lawrence and Amanda. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the discretion of the family. All guidelines from the IDPH will be followed by Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services for visitations and services. The use of face masks is encouraged. James Lee Anderson. James Lee Anderson, 75, of Pleasant Hill, formerly of Humboldt, passed away peaceable at his home on Thursday, May 7th, surrounded by his family after a lengthy illness with COPD. His body was cremated, and a celebration of life will be held at a later date in Humboldt. A complete obituary may be found at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Linda Shorman. Linda Shorman, 76, of Stratford, died May 9th. The family will have a private memorial and burial at Vigor Cemetery in Stratford. Barn's future is safe with new owners. Joe Pitzer is 86 years old, and last fall he sold the acreage where his barn is located to Kent and Mary Mollenbeck. The Mollenbecks had rented the property from Pitzer for 27 years. He sold the acreage to the Mollenbecks because he knew the barn would be safe and in good hands. The barn was built by a man whose last name was Bobst in 1869, who had bought the farmland in 1862. The barn was built for grain storage and hay. Livestock was kept outside. The next owners were the Dormans, purchasing the farm in 1913. In 1920, they moved the barn to its present location using a Hyder tractor. They built 8 stalls for 16 horses on the west side. Joe Pitzer's father, George, grew up in Fort Dodge and worked at a Fort Dodge tire store. In 1926, he was asked to run a tire store in Hampton and moved there. George Pitzer was asked by a customer if he wanted to buy a farm in 1936. The Dormans were being foreclosed. With a down payment of $1,000, George Pitzer bought 160 acres for $16,000. "He scraped the money together for the down payment," said Joe Pitzer. However, there was a problem. There was bad news and good news. First, the bad news. "He doesn't know anything about farming," said George Pitzer's father-in-law. "He'll lose his shirt." Now the good news. George Pitzer's hired man knew farming and made George Pitzer a farmer. In 1939, the Pitzer farm made the switch from horses to a tractor. "Dad didn't like horses," said Joe Pitzer. The west side of the barn that held the horse stalls was changed to dairying, with the horse stalls used for keeping calves. Joe Pitzer recalled his earliest memories of the barn. "I helped Dad run the separator and feed the stall calves. The Pitzers milked 12 to 16 cows year-round. Joe Pitzer learned by milking one cow at a time at age 11 or 12, then a year later he was up to 3 cows. The Pitzer barn was used for hogs and chickens with 500 laying hens. The hay mow held loose hay until the Pitzers bought a baler when Joe Pitzer was age 14 or 15. When Joe Pitzer enrolled at Iowa State in the fall of 1951, his father sold the dairy herd and went to beef cattle. He had around 30 head of crossbred cows in a cow-calf operation. The beef cattle continued until 1965, when Joe Pitzer retired. A renter used the east side of the barn for cattle. George Pitzer passed away in 1989 in the farmhouse. He remained active to the end, mowing his lawn and driving. Kent and Mary Mollenbeck both grew up on a farm. They are the parents of 4 children, ages 35, 30, 21, and 17 years. "We just like being in the country," said Mary Mollenbeck. "For years, I wanted to buy it." Our business. Highway Truck Equipment, Inc., continuing to serve you. Business name, Highway Truck Equipment, Inc. Location, 2246 First Avenue South. When was it founded? The company was founded in 1985 in Humboldt. Kathy and I, Brian Forsyth, purchased the company in December of 1997, and it has been located at our present address in Fort Dodge since that time. Who are the key leaders? Owners, Brian and Kathy Forsyth. Service managers, Mark McGuire and Heath Hanch. Parts manager, Kevin Dolder. And administrative specialist, Deb Dooley. How many people does it employ? A total of 15, 12 full-time employees and 3 part-time employees. What services and products do you provide? Sales and service of truck equipment, industrial parts supply, trailer and equipment repair. What are you doing differently to serve customers due to the COVID-19 pandemic? Increased sanitizing of all traffic areas, closed off shop areas to employees only, more communication online and on the phone, masks are available for all employees, maintaining social distancing. What is the biggest challenge your business has overcome recently? We have been fortunate that we had a sizable backlog of vehicles scheduled into the shop, so the mechanics have all stayed busy. The walk-in traffic for parts and service has decreased significantly. We have experienced some parts and equipment shortages, with some manufacturing facilities closing due to the virus. We have had to look for some new sources for essential items to keep jobs going. What is the biggest success your business has experienced recently? The shop expansion that was completed in June 2018 has increased the amount of vehicles that we are able to get through the shop. We have added more mechanics to help get vehicles completed in a timely fashion. We are still struggling to keep up with demand as sales have increased dramatically over the last 3 years. We greatly appreciate all of Central and Northern Iowa for their tremendous support they have shown us. Global transportation. The U.S. Grains Council is a trade association focused on promoting exports of corn, barley, sorghum, DDGs, and ethanol, and they aren't taking a backseat to COVID-19 as they are continuing to endorse those commodities during the pandemic. Ryan LeGrand, president and CEO of the U.S. Grains Council, said they have 9 offices across the world with plans to open their 10th location in Delhi, India, later this year. 106 employees and consultants here and abroad help us run programs in 50 countries worldwide, he said. It's very important to note that agriculture and agriculture's infrastructure have been deemed essential operations, so your work and ours will continue, said LeGrand. We've been receiving questions and concerns from customers and from governments from around the world about the continuity of operations of the U.S. grain export system. We put out a letter to our customers around the world in attempt to ensure the port operations will continue throughout the pandemic. We think it is very important to continue to ensure to the world we are open for business and we will remain open for business here in the United States. LeGrand said ports around the world are remaining operating as well, with the exceptions of some slowdowns in the receipts of vessels while crews are being examined. I am hearing some Chinese vessels into other countries are getting extra scrutiny right now, but again, around the world, everything is operating pretty much normally when it comes to the shipment and receipt of grains, he said. Regular buyers of U.S. corn, Japan, Korea, Mexico, and Colombia, LeGrand said, were active as of last month. We have been at an 11-month high. We are seeing that uptick in corn shipments, and it is a bright spot amongst all the bad news we are seeing and hearing around the world, he said. LeGrand said, we are waiting on more phases of the agreement, but is unsure how the first phase will be affected by the current pandemic. I'm sure it will be slowed down, he said. China made some serious commitments to the United States and the world in this phase one. And going forward, we expect them to make drastic changes on their acceptance and approval on new biotech traits. They have agreed to give an average of 24-month turnaround on any approvals of new events. If that holds, that is going to be a sweeping change for one of the largest consumers in the world, and it will benefit us greatly, provided China continues to comply with the phase one throughout the year. LeGrand said he expects China to be in the market for distillers' grains from the United States, and when the economics come back into play, we can expect them to be in the market for U.S. ethanol. Some of China's recent activity showed a near-record purchase at the end of March of about 756,000 metric tons of corn. That's just short of 30 million bushels they bought in one single purchase, said LeGrand. That's the largest purchase on record from what we have seen in the last 7 years by China. Hopefully, there are more good things to come with China and other nations. There are some bright spots among the bad news we are hearing. LeGrand said the U.S. Grains Council has been on the forefront of ethanol promotion for several years. "I would consider ethanol as our top priority of present," he said. "Ethanol has been United States' fastest-growing ag export over the past 10 years, so we are focusing our efforts of exporting this value-added product, but we can't forget the 66% of the exports are attributed to feed grains and distiller dried grains, so we will continue to put an emphasis of other products as well. Currently, ethanol prices are very low, with gasoline prices much lower than that. When you look back historically, ethanol is consistently priced below that of gasoline. That relationship has reversed recently, and we are seeing cheap gasoline prices, and it's making it very difficult for ethanol to compete," said LeGrand. When gasoline and ethanol demands return, what are the foreign imports that have the potential to import the most? LeGrand said Canada and Brazil are the top two markets for U.S. ethanol. "I would expect to continue to see strong shipments there," he said. "India is a big market for us on the industrial side, and we are working on the ground in India to try to get them to include fuel ethanol in their tenders. They are third or fourth, depending on the year, largest importer of our ethanol in the industrial basis. If they would include it in the fuel, that would really put India up close to the top or at the top of our export customers." Colombia, he added, continues to take more ethanol every year, and Peru has also increased their ethanol shipments from the United States. "There are some bright spots out there. We just need the gasoline demand to come back," he said. LeGrand said buyers of South American corn are looking more to the United States as an origin because they have confidence our supplies will continue to flow. They are worried about Argentina. The fear is that Argentina and other grain exporting ports around the world could shut down their operations, and that fear isn't quite as strong with the United States, he said. "We are seeing the same thing in Taiwan. Buyers are looking to book premiums in some instances just because they know the grain they buy from the United States is going to arrive on time at their port." A study was commissioned in 2018 to put a value on exports and the contribution of those exports to our ag economy. LeGrand said the results from the analysis show the $19.1 billion in grain and grain products exported indirectly supported a total economic output of $55 billion in 2016. In other words, access to international export markets for U.S. grains supported an additional $38 billion in business sales in 2016, he said. "This goes to show you the work we do around the world. It does have value. It brings value directly back to the farmer's bottom line and to the ag economy in general around the United States." And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, May 13th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice: physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.